Hi, I'm John Popola, and you're listening to the Emergent Order Podcast. On this episode of the Emergent Order Podcast, I talk with Professor David Thomas. David is a rare professor in that he actually has real-world experience in starting businesses. He's a serial technology entrepreneur that's played a really pivotal role in the technologies we all use and how we even describe them. He later became an economist and is now a professor at Ball State University. I first met David on our macroeconomics roundtable conversation, which is a prior episode, so I encourage you to check that out. But I think this is a great conversation that really gives you a window into tech entrepreneurship and, you know, how an incredible life can transition into lots of different careers over the course of time. Which I think is incredibly inspiring. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Professor David Thomas. So, David, we got introduced during a high-flying intellectual exchange about macroeconomics. And at the tail end of that, you gave me a little window into your remarkable career history. And so I thought, we've really got to have a conversation together so to share your story with the people that listen to our show. And it's very in keeping with the conversations we've had on the Emergent Order podcast, which is really about this sort of intersection of technology, entrepreneurship, and culture, and the culture of freedom. So, you know, I want to start, as I often do, from the beginning, where you got into tech early, but start me with your education, because you told me that your education takes some interesting twists and turns, and you're a professor now, and we're going to circle back to education towards the end here. But where do you start? Where do you start in, like, start in college? Or even better, were you a tinkerer in high school before you got to college? What did you like to do? Like, what planted the seeds for your college career?
Well, so I grew up in a family of 10 children, and my father was a scientist. He had graduate degrees in chemistry, physics, and mathematics, and he had a laboratory at home. So, you know, we spent a lot of time around that kind of a world. And yes, I was a tinkerer. I was involved in those kinds of things from a very early age. I found school boring mostly. I typically looked out the window and got in trouble because I wasn't paying attention, supposedly. But my oldest brother was a very successful attorney practicing corporate law. And he said, look, why don't you get a degree in accounting and then a law degree and come work with me as a partner? And so that was the path that I was pursuing. And what happened was, is I discovered that accounting was horrific. I love accounting, but I felt like if I actually had to do this, I would have to kill myself. It was just so bad. And then I did an internship over the summer with my brother's law firm and discovered that it was actually worse than accounting, because all you did was just read cases and write and most boring stuff. It wasn't like what you saw on television at all. And so during that time, I'd been tinkering with some of these home computer kits. You couldn't buy a computer per se. Back then you had to buy components and put it together.
And what years are this? Where to set us in time?
So this is 1975, 76.
Right.
And so I had gone down to the little local bike shop, BYTE bike shop, there by Arizona State University, and I'd bought an MSI front panel, and this won't mean anything to anybody, but anyway, and an S100 bus, and I bought the memory cards and put this all together, and I built my own, you know, computer for me to tinker with, and I was playing with that and thinking, hey, you know, there's a lot happening here. This is going to have a big effect on the world. And so I added,
why did you think that at the time? I mean, you know, I know it's so easy to, in retrospect, have it feel obvious that computers are going to be a revolution, but you know, when you go back to this before the IBM PC, that wasn't common knowledge. That wasn't a commonly held belief.
No, because very few people actually had access to a computer. So they wouldn't have any way of knowing what was coming. This was happening. It was kind of sequestered. You know, something happening behind the scenes. There were some of us that were doing this, right? There was the Homebrew Computer Club over there in the Silicon Valley. I happened to be in Arizona at ASU. But we were all doing the same thing. We were all playing with these kits and thinking, oh boy, you know, this is going to have a big effect on the world, and I want to get involved in this. And so I added to my major computer information systems. And of course, at that time, that meant writing programs in COBOL and Fortran, creating IBM punch cards, carrying a box of cards down to the computer room. They don't trip, whatever you do. And then handing those, they run them, and then you get your printout and go back. And so that was sort of the world I was experiencing at school. But at home, I had this, you know, personal computer I was playing with. And so I came to the conclusion that this was going to be the future, and that if I hated accounting, there were a lot of other people that did as well. And so if I could automate the accounting process and make it better, I could probably make a lot of money. And so I had an extra bedroom. I set it up. And then, you know, one thing that college students have in abundance, they don't have any money, but they have lots and lots of time.
It's true.
I mean, we all pretend that, oh, college is so busy, I've got so much work to do. The reality is a few hours a day and you're done, right? With your classes, especially in undergrad. I mean, I never took a book home. Well, I hope my kids aren't listening. I never took a book home in high school. Okay. I did all my homework during class, and just because I wanted to, you know, do other things with my time.
Right.
And so in college was kind of the same sort of a thing. And so I had lots of time, and I didn't have any money, but I had lots of time. And so I just devoted that extra time sitting in that extra bedroom. Driving my wife crazy, but I was sitting in there just, you know, writing code as fast as I could, and writing this accounting system. And so I wrote the first accounting system for the PC, not the IBM PC, but the personal computer. And because they were now starting to come out, these computers were starting to come out where you could buy them in stores, the little shops were anxious. They would actually buy demos from me. So I had a demo disc.
And they would just buy them right off you.
And they would pay me to get something just to show, look, accounting works on these machines.
So what operating system, like get geeky with me here for a little bit, because it's like,
back then it was CPM. CPM was the predecessor to MS-DOS.
Right.
And there's a story there, of course, that the creator of CPM was Gary Kildall. He was a former digital equipment guy, and all DEC people hated IBM. So he was an anti-IBM former DEC guy. And CPM looked a lot like the DEC operating system, which I had used at the university. So what happened was that when IBM decided to get into the business, they were told, you can't do any of this yourself because of potential violations of, you're too great and powerful. And so they had to license everything. And so they said, well, we'll need an operating system. So they approached Gary Kildall and said, you know, we'd like to use CPM as our operating system. Well, Gary saw this as an opportunity to snub IBM. So he had them waiting in his waiting room while he was up flying his plane, and he made them wait for several hours while he delayed his meeting. Well, during that time, from his phone in his lobby, they actually got on the phone and called Bill Gates and said, look, can you write an operating system for us? Bill had no idea.
Right. He had written BASIC for, was it?
Yeah. Well, they were going to use his BASIC.
Gotcha.
BASIC. Microsoft had one product, BASIC, MBASIC. Microsoft BASIC. And it ran on CPM. And so they asked Bill, could you write an operating system for us? And Bill just said, oh, sure. Yeah, we could do that. He had no idea, right? So it turns out that he actually licensed an illegal copy of CPM from a former Gary Kildall employee and used that as the basis for MS-DOS. And
that, that, yes.
that made it really easy for me because it was the same operating system. All they did was change the interrupt from 5 to 21. So at the very lowest level, instead of calling interrupt 5, it called interrupt 21. Otherwise, it was identical. Okay. So I just wrote a little routine that trapped all the interrupt 21 calls, translated it, called interrupt 5, brought it back, and then returned the result back to interrupt 21. And all of a sudden, all my software ran on MS-DOS.
So this is all, so this is accounting, but it's all, was there any kind of graphical user interface? Like how did it work? Like how would you use accounting software without a GUI?
So we kind of created our own GUI. The monitors back then, the dumb monitors that hooked up were all character based. So you had, instead of pixels, say, you could put an A here and a 1 here type thing, and you could change the colors and the backgrounds. And they had the ability to map to various positions on the screen. So we wrote a translation table for every monitor. And then when you installed it, you'd say, well, I have this monitor, and it would translate that to display our graphical interface. It wasn't really a graphical interface, but it had menus.
Yeah. Okay, so you've written this, the first piece of accounting software for a personal computer. What happens next? And how old are you at this point?
So I'm in my mid-20s, I'm still at ASU. I'm, in my senior year at ASU. And all of a sudden, the orders started coming in like crazy. And I just couldn't keep up with it. So halfway through my senior year, one semester left, I dropped out. I said, I can always go back later. Guess what? I'm in good company. Bill Gates dropped out. Steve Jobs dropped. I mean, I didn't do as well as they did. I chose the wrong part of the industry if I was wanting to become a billionaire. But anyway, but like them, I dropped out and devoted myself to that business. Well, the business grew tremendously. And then, of course, when the IBM PC came out, I had the first product on it, and everybody needed accounting software, and the business was just phenomenally successful. I never raised venture capital. It was self-funded because the orders just came in and were prepaid for. So the business grew and grew and grew. And then I was approached by a venture capitalist in 1983 or 84. And he said, look, I'd like to put $1 million of venture capital into your business, help you grow it. And I said, well, that sounds good. He was going to take like 10%, 15% of the business. And they were. And I said, okay, well, let's put the paperwork together and do something. Well, a few days later, I get a call from an investment banking firm, M&A firm. They said, we have a buyer who will pay you $15 million cash for your business. And I'm like 28 years old. And I'm thinking, $1 sounds pretty good to me. So I called this venture capitalist up and I said, look, I'm going to not take your money. I've got a buyer for $15 million for my business. And I remember his response. He said, you are smoking dope. Like you're going to get $15 million for that business, right? Well, it turns out that my biggest competitor, which was run by Ann Winblad, who's the venture capitalist today, run by Ann Winblad, had just sold her company for $15 million. And there were a whole bunch of suitors. So the investment bankers had all these suitors, and it was sold, so they turned to the other company and said, let's sell this one too, right? And so anyway, McGraw-Hill came in and bought my company, and I worked for them for 3 years running their financial software division, and then I retired.
Yeah, so you had said that you had retired. So you were in your late 20s and you retired. So why, put yourself in that moment. You have this incredibly exciting windfall, and this is in the, is this still the late 70s or is this the early 80s now?
This is mid 80s, yeah.
So 15 million then is probably somewhere north of 30 or even 50 today.
It's enough money, you don't worry about it.
Yeah, you're just like, okay, I'm this is incredible. So did you think I can retire now? I can retire in my late 20s? Like, when you say retire, what does that mean?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because at the time I just thought, okay, I'm going to retire from this and I'm going to do a bunch of cool stuff I always wanted. You know, I always had projects and things, and I had young family, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to travel around the world with my kids and spend time with my family? Because remember, I'd been working 7 days a week, you know, 14 hours a day for 6 or 7 years. I hadn't really seen my family. I mean, it's a lot of work building a company like that.
Yeah.
And I just thought I would like to spend more time with my wife and kids. And so I retired. And we did that for a while. We, you know, traveled to Europe and we did in Australia and things. You know, we did a bunch of that. And I bought a big house with a nice work room. And it was interesting for about 6 months.
So you start to get bored.
Really bored.
And why do you think that is? Because that's a common, I hear this a lot. I certainly feel that way. If I go on a vacation for more than 3 weeks, I start to get antsy. I can't even remember. I don't even know if I've gone on vacation for more than a week and a half in the past decade. Is that inherent in people, do you think? Is it a personality type? Is it everybody? What do you think is this drive to like get back to doing something?
Oh, I think a lot of it's just me. I'm broken. I just can't stop working. Even if I was in my hospital bed, you know, a couple of weeks ago, and I've got my laptop and I'm working and I'm driving, I don't know any better.
So what comes next? So you're getting antsy, high flying around.
So my oldest son had started playing video games. Now these were chunky games back then, but one of the games that he started playing at that time was a game called SimCity. A lot of people have heard of the SimCity. And I was really impressed by the fact that, you know, they were simulating, you know, the building of a city, and it was animated and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do that with a business? And so I told my son, let's do this together. This will give us something to do. We'll write the code. So I wrote it in C and C++. And I also wanted to learn how to program in C and C++ anyway. So it was another excuse for that. And so we sat down and we created this game, and we were trying to figure out what to call it. You know, can't call it Sim Business, because that would be a trademark violation. And so we thought, we got to make it interesting and fun. So I ended up trademarking the name Capitalist Pig. And, that was the name of the game, and it was a lot of fun.
Now, what was the graphical experience like, and how did you get that? You know, you're writing code, but did you hire an artist to do graphics, or how did that happen?
So my oldest son is quite artistic, and very, very artistic. In fact, he has an undergraduate degree in digital animation. And I said, why don't you take a shot at some of the graphics? And so he did. And so it was very simplistic, but of course back then most of them were anyway, right?
Right.
So he did that. I did hire some top-notch graphical people to do the user manual, the packaging, splash screens, things like that.
And what happened, Steve? I remember seeing Capitalist Pig back when there was a software was sold physically in boxes on shelves at places like.
Oh yeah, we were a top 10 best-selling game for a few weeks back in 1990, and in fact, if you Google Capitalist Pig the game on the internet, some people have recorded playing it, and you can see the packaging. I mean, it's kind of still out there, so that's kind of fun.
Did you think, okay, now I'm in the game business, what else can we come up with in that now? Or what was the, how did that start to take shape? You were in a different, you're now in the consumer software side.
I didn't have any interest in that. No, that was just a project with my son. But it got me, you know, back into the groove of programming and so forth. And so what happened was when the internet came and started to emerge in the mid 90s, I had that same feeling as I had with the PC. This is going to change everything. It's going to change the world. and I want to get engaged in this. And so I looked at it and I said, you know, one of the biggest problems they have in the accounting world and in corporate America is all these disparate databases spread all over the world and in different business units. And they have no way of sort of looking at a single view of, say, a customer or a vendor. And wouldn't it be great if through the internet connectivity of the internet to be able to draw the data out of all of those systems, put it into a single dashboard so that if you're on the phone with somebody at Bank of America, they can talk to you, oh, you also have this credit card and you also have this loan and you also have, right? And so we built this system with a company called BroadQuest, and I was lucky enough to be introduced to a computer scientist at IBM, brilliant guy, Odysseas Satalos from Greece, who has since become one of my very best friends. And he had developed a technology he called DataWeb, which was perfect for the back end piece of this idea. And so we got together and we founded this company. And we built it and we got some great customers, big banks and manufacturing companies to start using it and buying it from us. And it was about that time that Y2K was looming.
Right.
And so all these big corporations put all the projects on hold. And so we weren't making any sales. It's also the same time as the boom in the dot-coms hit. So 99, 98, 99. And so my board came to me and they said, we want you to change the business. We want you to refund the money to these banks and everybody. We'll, you know, we've given you $30 million and we would like you to turn this into a dot-com business. Start making dashboards for consumers.
So I want to take one half step back. So you just said that you had a board, you had raised tens of millions of dollars towards this new venture. Talk me through that. How did you at this point start this new, you had this concept. Walk me through that a little bit. Like, how do you go from concept at that stage, at that time, to having the product and having a board and having a mix of probably equity and debt? And
sure.
I know that's a big question, but like, what were kind of the core steps there?
Yeah, I mean, I just take a lot of these things for granted. I apologize. So the first step was we got some angel investors. Stuart Alsop, I don't know if you know who he is, but Stuart Alsop was one of the sort of chief media guys in the tech industry for a very long time, now a venture capitalist. And, you know, he was the editor of InfoWorld or you know, a whole bunch of different journalists.
Yep.
Anyway, he and I were chatting one day and he said to me, he said, David, never invest in your own business. You're not a venture capitalist. You're an entrepreneur. Never invest your own money. And this is really good advice because the venture capitalists have a special model that allows them to do this. And as an individual, you don't have that ability. You cannot diversify. You cannot tranche. You cannot do the things that they do. So you're going to lose your money. You're going to bankrupt yourself if you invest in your business. The exception to that, of course, if you're a college student, then all you're investing is your time. That's a different story. Okay, so the first thing was we got angel investors, about 20 people, very wealthy, to put up about $25,000 each. And we explained to them, look, this is just angel money to kind of get a proof of concept built. And then we're going to raise venture capital. So you don't have to put any more money in. This is it. And
when an angel comes in at that stage, it's obviously the highest risk investor, right?
Right.
So what does it look like for them relative to the investors that come next? I don't know that I've talked to anybody really quite about the way the sort of stages of investment work, but are they getting a premium return if things work out? Like, do they have a larger share of ownership? What's it look like?
Yeah, they get a very significant share of ownership early on. Of course, it gets diluted as more rounds come in, but they get a big enough share that for $25,000, they could make millions of dollars if it's successful, right? So what they'll do is they'll invest in maybe 20 or 30 little companies, early stage, put $25,000. They're worth maybe, you know, $200 or $300 million. So what's $25,000? Nothing, right? So they throw $25,000 around to 20 or 30 companies, and one or two of them will become successful and they'll make a bunch of money. Plus they like to be involved and hear what's going on and so forth.
So you have these angels. Are any of them family, or is it all people that are just out there? And I know sometimes angels will be family members, which probably is complicated.
Well, I would just say to anybody, never do business with family, because it's a dual relationship. You're bound to have problems. Just stay away from it. In this case, I did not bring any family in.
Gotcha. So did you get to a full-fledged prototype with that seed round of financing, or how far did you get before you felt you were ready to roadshow this out to other investors? And how did that happen?
So we had a prototype built with that money. There were only about six of us working on it. So I think we raised $1.5 million. It was plenty of money, right, to get the prototype done. And so we were able to demonstrate the capabilities on top of a database. And so then we said, okay, now we'll raise the venture. And so we were lucky to get money from a very, very prominent venture firm. And I think they gave us $20 million initially. And I mean, it's enterprise software. You need quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
And that gave us the money to really hire up a lot of engineers, build, you know, create an actual organization, a sales force, customer service department, all that kind of stuff. And of course, the next step is get customers. And I think it only took us about 3 million of the 20 million to get our first two or three customers. So we were doing phenomenally well. So we had 17 million left when they came to me and said, we want to switch the business.
So you still have all this cash in the bank. You had customers, but you've got this moment now where things are sort of pausing because of this convergence of technological stuff, the Y2K and .com. So I guess one other technical question I had for you is at this stage. So we take a lot of these things for granted now, but if you're building a dashboard to draw on these databases that are out there, how are you getting access to this? Like, where is this data that you're drawing in, pulling in? Is it a tool for like companies to use in like the data they already have internally? So it's not drawing on like internet-based databases.
No, it's all internal data, right? But they might have an SAP system, and they might have a Siebel system, and they might have, and these systems are not really compatible with each other, and the data structures are different. And a lot of times the data is dirty, and it's, you know, it's very hard to map the data. And so what this tool did was it sat on top of these different systems, could query the systems, organize the data into something that looked, you know, like a common set of data, and then bring that information into a dashboard.
Cool. And then so your board is saying, we got to go .com on this, man. This pets.com is blowing up. We got to be the next pets.com. There's these Amazon guy. He's doing something crazy with books. We got to do something in this. So what happens with this conversation?
So we had this conversation and I said, I don't believe that this is real. I don't believe that there is a new business model. I think business is about selling products and services and making money. And, you know, this idea of eyes or whatever might work for Google, but I just don't see this as a future. And so I would like to be bought out and leave.
So you start this company and you were the co-founder and CEO. Is that what the... So how does it come to be the case that that you would leave your own company because this board is telling you to do something that you didn't want to do? Well, how does that power
governance structure happen and work? And because you hear, well, I mean, we've all heard, most of us have heard, like, Steve Jobs got kicked out and these things, but like, how do you go from, I have this idea, I've raised this money, I made this product, to I'm being told by these people to take it in a different direction, and it wouldn't exist without me, but I'm being told, like, what's going on there?
So once you take venture money, they pretty much own your soul, even though they don't have controlling interest of the shares. What are you going to do? Say, no, we're not going to do that. I mean, you, if they pull their support, what do you do for the next round of capital? They're not going to give it to you, right? So you can't take that risk. I just heard so much, and they were all, you know, unified in their voice. And I just said, I can't go there. So either we stay the course and weather the Y2K, or you need to find a new chief executive officer. And I'm happy to give you some time, you know, like if you need 6 months or whatever. So I gave them some time, and I stayed there while they recruited somebody else to take over. I did really well.
I think we had a little hiccup there. You said you gave them some time, and then what happened?
Yeah, I gave them some time, and then they helped recruit a new CEO, and then they bought me out, and then I left.
What part, looking back, what part of your intuition was right, and what part was wrong? Because in 2020, looking at the world we live in and all these at the time, that in 99 is when I got out of school, and I was working at MTV Animation, and there were all these crazy new animation companies, and Atom Films and Macromedia Flash was going to change the world. And everybody got swept up into that. We've got to start doing that. And then it all came crashing down, and the department was eliminated along with my job. So I remember that moment really intensely, but out of those ashes still came Amazon and Google and PayPal and eBay. And a lot of them did have pretty different business models, like Google and then the social media and advertising based stuff. So which part were you, do you look back and say, I was right? And which part do you look back and say, well, no, there was something there that maybe had I stayed in that path would have been something else?
Well, so I never doubted that the internet was going to change the world, and that's where all the future would be. That wasn't the issue that I had. The issue I had was with the .com thing. The idea that you just put .com on the end of your company name and you somehow offer something over the internet, and that makes you rich. You have to have a real business model that can be monetized. And Amazon, I tell my students, Amazon is not in the business you think they're in. Amazon is in the transaction reduction business. Their job is just reducing transaction costs, right? So you have four kinds of transactions: search, bargaining, contracting, and transfer costs. And every transaction has those four elements, right? You gotta find somebody who wants to buy what you wanna sell. You have to agree on a price. You have to agree on the terms of the deal, and then you have to transfer the money in the product, right? And all of that is, those are the costs of the transaction. That's Amazon's business, reducing those four costs.
It's been interesting to watch how Amazon has just continually evolved, and
so amazing.
And I've heard some interesting explanations of the sort of emergent order of their internal discovery process, that they're like a company composed of networks of experiments that take shape and become business units and live or die. They seem to have done that more effectively than a Google from the outside looking in. It's like Google spun up a lot of things that don't turn into a good product, or even if it's good, they kill it. Amazon seems to have done more.
Google does a similar sort of a thing, right? My son-in-law is a senior engineer at Google, and And so he's always, you know, here, try this, try that, you know. My daughter works at Apple, so upstairs it's okay, Google, and downstairs it's hey Siri.
So both of your, so how many kids do you have, David?
I have five.
How, and so we just heard, so two of them are in big tech companies. How, are all of your kids into technology, or do you have any black sheep liberal artists among them?
So my oldest is the CIO, you know, type executive there in Silicon Valley. He's the only one left. The rest have moved away. My oldest daughter has a graduate degree in neuropsychology, but her husband's a lawyer and he's legal counsel for Overstock.com. So technology.
Yeah.
And then my third daughter's married to the guy that she was a consultant with Accenture, doing Salesforce.com implementations. And then she married this guy who was at Google. And then my youngest daughter works at Apple, but my fourth child is a gastroenterologist.
Oh, right. Well, I've had GERD since 2003. So he's my guy. okay. So you exit your the dashboard business, and and .com boom turns to bust. So
yeah, but I have to be honest. I also had another reason for wanting to leave.
Please tell me.
I had a new idea.
All right.
And my new idea was actually an old idea. So. When I had originally started working on computers and I got off mainframes, I started working on time-sharing computers. And the time-sharing computer was a dumb terminal that was connected to basically a big mainframe-type computer, and you could have 50 or 100 of these running at the same time, and you were sharing the CPU and the storage. And at Arizona State, that's what we had was that.
So that, and, I've also heard that called sort of thin client computing, right?
Yeah, that's another way of describing it, but very thin, right? Yeah. Dumb terminals, nothing smart in them at all.
Just anyway, a keyboard and a screen and cables go into the brains somewhere else.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, that was a nice model because I never had to worry about the computer. I never had to worry about the operating system or backing it up or anything. All I had to do was just use it, and that was really nice, right? Because I didn't have to mess with it. And so I saw the internet as sort of like the ultimate time-sharing computer.
Hmm.
And I thought, why couldn't I resurrect the old time-sharing model and create accounting software in that environment? And that way, businesses would not have to buy hardware, software, do backups, all the stuff that they hate to do. They would just be able to, through the internet, access it anywhere, anytime, and eliminate all of that from their hassle. And they could just rent it, you know, month to month, year to year, whatever. They wouldn't have to deal with all of the other stuff. And so I came up with that idea. And of course, some other people started doing a similar sort of a thing about the same time. Mark Benioff launched his company, Salesforce.com, about the same time. And a lot of us were just working on it secretly, but we all knew about each other and were chatting. And so I said, I really think that's a potentially much bigger business than dashboards.
So I remember during the browser wars, Netflix, Netscape, the Netscape CEO, I think it said something to the effect of he wanted to reduce Windows into just a buggy collection of drivers. and at the time, I remember in those early days, I think I took a flight and someone said to me that I was sitting next to was in internet software and said, you're going to be everything you can do right now on your desktop computer with software that's installed and running locally, you're going to be able to do with software that's running on a server the system you're working on physically is a dumb client. It's a thin, dumb client.
Yep.
And all going to be happening. And I was like, I was really skeptical. I was like, you know, I don't know, man, the internet's not that fast. What about video editing, video games? How are you going to, and now today they're streaming 4K video with all the video games now are moving to the actual processing power being in the server room somewhere. So, I mean, that was a big idea to have at that point. It was it in the air? You said they're like, you had Benioff and a couple others, like, or was it not? How deterministic did it feel at that moment that this is where things were going to head?
Oh, I think I felt like we were all pioneers at that point in time. You know, that there were just a handful of us that sort of got the idea, but we saw clearly this was the way it was. I mean, there was no doubt in our minds that this was the way it had to go. There were just too many benefits, right, to making it happen. And I also thought, well, it's too early because the technology is not quite there, but I also knew it was going to take several years to build it, and that by the time we got it done, the technology would be there.
So you exit the dashboard business, you've got this really truly a visionary concept. And what happens next? What's the next step for you?
So I got together with my Greek friend from the company and my kitchen one day. I told him about it. He said, oh, this sounds great. We should do this. He's still there working, right? And we started, you know, putting it down on napkins, right? Penciling it all out, how it would work and so forth. He helped me set up a server there in the kitchen, and I just, you know, started writing code. And he would come over after work and say, well, try this and try that. And we started experimenting with different things. And so he was involved fairly early on. And then about a year later, he quit there and came to work with me full time, you know, as a co-founder for this new business. So we kind of got the first general ledger prototyped and kind of working, and it was working pretty cool. And about this time, I was attending a CEO conference. Back then, they had this conference called Agenda. It's been gone for a long time. But for about 7 or 8 years, Stuart Alsop put this conference on. He invited the top 200 or 300 CEOs from the tech industry to come to a very, very expensive resort for 4 or 5 days, have the spouses play tennis and golf while the rest of us got together and discuss the future. And boy, do I have some stories I can tell you about some of the things that happened in those meetings. Amazing. I had a conversation with Steve Jobs in the foyer one day.
Yeah, tell me about that, because he is one of my all-time heroes. And even if what you're going to say is horrible, I'll still love him. but yeah.
Oh no, we love Steve, but we also know he was very difficult. So this was at the time, I'll go back to it. So this was at the time he had the Next computer. Yes. He had left Apple and he had created the Next. And it wasn't doing well. And I had bought one of the Next computers to play with, you know, as a toy. And so we were in the foyer, we'd both gone out to make calls or whatever. And we started chatting and I said, look, Steve, I think your new computer is beautiful. The interface is amazing. And he said, but he knew I was going to say something, right? I said, but it needs a killer app. You know, I said, the PC had, you know, the spreadsheet, and the Mac had PageMaker. You need a killer app, something that's going to force everybody to buy these. And he said, and so what would that app be? He knew I had some, you know, idea that I wanted to say. I said, well, I've thought about, you know, your analog digital chip and a bunch of other things. I thought, what about, you know, Movie Maker, something that would allow me to produce videos, maybe 15, 20 minute videos for home use, education, business, political, there's so many different people that would benefit from being able to easily produce videos for various purposes, and you have all the tools. And he looked at me, he said, that is the dumbest idea I have ever heard. And then he turned around and walked away. And about 6 months later, he was at Apple. And what's the first app they built?
iMovie. Yep.
Now, I'm not taking credit for that, but that's Steve.
Yeah, it is. It's that one of the things that I find so powerful about jobs that, and this was true of my boss at Spike, is people will often get irked when someone reverses course, right? Where they say, oh, you're never gonna, we're never gonna do Flash, and then they turn around and release a product with Flash. Or, you know, my boss at Spike, he would often give feedback. He was the creative director, or he'd have an idea for a spot or a commercial, and you'd go off and try to bring that idea to life, and you'd bring it back to him and be like, oh no, that sucks, that's terrible. And a lot of people get frustrated by that, but I learned a lot from that process, because it's like, it's so easy to fall in love with your own ideas that to be able to recognize you're wrong and reverse course, I think, is this like really important skill. And I think that's, to me, that's how I interpret those Steve Jobs sort of, you know, it's like strong opinions loosely held. Like he was like, no, that's a terrible idea. And then at some point it's like, actually, that's a great idea. Let's do that.
My wife will often tell people that, they'll say, oh man, your husband's so opinionated. That is true. I'm difficult. And they'll say, yeah, he's so opinionated. She says, yeah, but if you show him he's wrong, he'll change. He'll change it immediately. And I think as an academic, this is something that we all need to do. It's very difficult in anywhere in life, right? And academia is probably worse than any place. Everybody has their little pet projects. They don't want to let them go. You show them all the evidence in the world and they won't stop. They'll keep working on it. And what we have to do is we have to be able to say, oh, that was wrong. Because what is it we're really trying to do? We're trying to find the truth.
I have a theory for why that's more, I think, actually more prevalent in academia. I'm curious what you think now that you're an academic. And I think here's my theory. My theory is that every pursuit has its currency. And in the business world, one of the yardsticks is financial performance. Maybe it's not the most important one, but you could say it's the most important one. So you don't have that in academia. So the currency moves to something like status. And so if you've built your status around an idea that's associated with you, it's really hard to say, oh, I was wrong. Animal spirits isn't the thing that matters for the economy. I was wrong about that. I thought that was true, but the data doesn't support it. You know, your identity is wrapped up in this idea, and that's the currency. I'm curious if you whether you think that's there's some truth.
I think you're absolutely right. That's exactly what's happening. But individual, business, academia, it's all that way.
So you're building this, you know, cloud computing accounting software, right? How are you doing it? Do you have like do you have multiple computers at your house? So one is acting as the server and you're trying it out with another one as the client? Like, how is it working?
Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah. So we have two computers. We have a server set up, and then we have a desktop computer acting as a client with a browser.
And so what happens next? How does it start to take shape? And you know,
your Greek buddy
comes on board.
So we had to develop not just the interface, right? We had to develop an architecture, and the architecture had to be different because it was the internet. So we ended up having to create a three-tiered architecture, whereas client desktop is one tier, you and the computer operating, right? Client server, which is what most corporations were using at that time, was a two-tier architecture. You had a database server and you had a client that accessed it. Okay. Well, on the internet, you can't do that, right? So
why?
Because now anybody can access it. It's open to the public, so to speak. It's out there, right?
Yeah.
So for security and other purposes, and it has to scale. So we had to create a three-tier architecture, which is you have the database back here, okay? And then you have this piece in between that is the business logic, because you have to be able to make changes to the database whenever you want and not have it break everybody's apps and not have it break anybody's integrations. So the business logic layer can be rock solid. It never changes, but you can mess with the database, come up with new versions, do whatever you want, as long as the business logic layer continues to talk to it. And then you have the app layer in front of that that talks to the business logic layer, which supports the browser. But you also have the ability to have APIs, application programmer interfaces, for partners to be able to integrate with your accounting system and so forth. Like we integrated with Salesforce.com. Well, they needed to be able to talk to the business logic layer. They don't want to talk to the browser, right, interface. They want to talk to the business logic layer and be able to always rely on it returning the same information. So we had to develop this architecture like that.
And is that in a sense different programs that are running in different ways on multiple computers? Like when you say these, you know, one of the things that I always, you know, I think I told this to you, that my approach to economics is always basically Robinson Crusoe. I just go down to Robinson Crusoe and that's where I start every time. With computing, I always sort of, especially with this cloud computing stuff, I like to try to think back to, okay, well, where is the computer running what? what are these different programs that are sort of reading and writing to each other's sort of data? What does it mean to have an architecture like you're describing?
So we had a name for this, multi-tenant architecture. And the idea is that each client is a tenant, but they're all running on the same system, right? And yet you can't have their data crossover. You don't want company A to see company B's business, right? Yet they're all running on these big databases, right? And so we had to have the ability to be able to strip out, as it grows, you get up to 17,000 enterprises, you can't run that all on one computer. It's got to be able to run on 100 servers, right? And you have to have the ability to pull the data out from those and say, okay, well, companies 1 through 10 are over here and 20 through 30 are over here, and keep doing that. You know, Google has the same problem, right? That's the be able to spread it out. So this multi-tenant architecture, and we wrote up a white paper on it, explained how it had to work. And so you have this, the back end, which is all these databases, and they could be wherever you want them to be, running on different servers. And you have a business logic layer that maps to the appropriate server, depending on who the tenant is, make sure that the data never crosses over. And then you have the application layer in front of that, producing the interface for the browsers. So it's very, very sophisticated. Years later, Oracle actually built multi-tenant capabilities into their database to support that idea. But so that didn't come for like 4 or 5 years later.
I mean, what you're describing sounds a lot like the fundamental concepts that run probably just about everything we do now whenever we open a web browser. Is that fair to say? Is that basic sort of categorization still true? So I go to Facebook and I open up the browser, and it's the images and the interfaces serve to me, but then all of my posts are all stored in a database and everybody else's posts and content are stored in the database, but I can't see the others unless they can see. It sounds like it's all the same concepts. Yeah,
so everybody uses the multi-tenant architecture, everybody. You have to. It doesn't scale otherwise.
Was this just thrilling? I mean, you know, you're building this thing and it's this whole new way of delivering computing.
Oh, we were so excited, right? Because we're inventing all these new ideas, right? Breakthrough ideas to make things work. Huge problems. How do you get around them? Got to come up with new ways to do this. Yeah. And fortunately, I had Odysseus there, who was a brilliant database guy who could figure this all out, right? So he was the brilliant guy who figured out how to manage all these multi-tenant approaches and so forth. Because I'm not a database guy. I mean, I know a lot about databases. I built one early on, but not at that level. You know, he has a PhD in computer science from Madison, Wisconsin, and databases, the home of COD. And, you know, he's just a brilliant guy.
So this was, what did this become? What was the, what was the company and the product that, that ultimately?
So this was a company called Intacct, I-N-T-A-C-C-T, based on the word internet and accounting, right? Intacct. And the business did really well. I mean, from early on, we started getting clients quickly. When I left, there were about 2,000 or 3,000 enterprises on it, and it was growing, and it was a recurring revenue model. Right. Every month you knew what your revenue was going to be. There was no surprise, which I like. I don't like surprises.
Now, what does the CEO role mean? And you know, you look back on these different things that, so, that you've done, you've founded and that you've led. And you know, to hear you talk, you know, describe the beginning of this platform, you're there at your table writing the code, and so there's a kind of there's a very tangible sense in which like people can get that. Oh yeah, well, David was the guy writing the code at the beginning, but as it gets more complicated, your role as the CEO, I think, the CEO job, I think, is pretty abstract for people. So what does it mean to be the CEO of a firm? Like what are you doing that only you can do as the CEO?
Well, so early on, I was writing some code, but very quickly, when we got the venture, I stopped. And I hired world-class people to do that who were better, much better than me. And I move to my full role as a CEO. So what is my role? Well, my role is to set the culture of the corporation. So that's very, very important. Number two is, of course, to raise money and manage the board, right? And to set the strategic direction of the organization, make sure that we're staying on track and moving in the right direction. So in this case, I raised some seed capital, I think about 1.1 million easily. I just sent an email out to my other seed investors and they wrote out checks. And so I had my 1.1 million. And I was back at this conference I was telling you about. And I was kind of moving around, keeping secret what I was doing and observing things. And suddenly I heard this voice, and it was Ann Winblad, you know, the former competitor of venture capitalist who I knew well. And she said, "Hi, David, how you doing?" I said, "Oh, hi, Ann, how you doing?" So we started chatting and she says, "Okay, I know you're up to something. So tell me what it is." And I said, "I can't tell you." You know, I the usual response, right? I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. And she says, come on. She pulls me over to a corner, sits me down, says, "Come on, tell me all about it." And I said, "Okay." So I told her what I was doing. And she said, "I'm in for $10 million."
And remind me again, who is Ann Winblad?
Ann Winblad.
Okay.
Is probably the most well-known female venture capitalist. She's senior partner and founder of Hummer Winblad. She very well connected with Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer and a bunch of those other people. I think they manage a couple of $1 billion and in venture money. She's kind of famous for having invested in pets.com and Napster, because there were some scandals involved in those, but she's done well and their firm has done well. So one of their successful investments was a company called Intacct. So they put $10 million into my business.
So, you coin a term that has been accelerating its consumption of all of technology. So tell me about this. You told me about it, but like I'm teeing you up for it. So when does this happen,
when a bunch of us launched our businesses, Salesforce.com and ourselves and a few others, the press didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know how to classify us. Are you software companies? No, we don't sell software. Well, do you sell hardware? No, we don't sell hardware. Well, Are you a website? No, we're not a website. So we had this problem, right? We needed to have a universal descriptor category that we could be put in that would be positive and would describe what we were doing. And I was very concerned about this. And so I called Mark Benioff and I said, hey, Mark, you've got a nice little office there in San Francisco. I'd like to have a meeting and gather the top 10 or 12 of us together and discuss this problem because it's a real problem and we need to address it. And he agreed. And so we scheduled a meeting. And in the meantime, I started thinking about how would we position ourselves and how would we come up with this? And I said to myself, the key thing here is that we're providing a service, not a product anymore. We don't have versions. We don't have boxes.
Right.
No, it's a service. But of course, it's software. And so it seemed obvious we just say software as a service, right? And so I proposed that to the group. And they didn't like the idea of SaaS, but you know, it is what it is. And everybody agreed. And so we all kind of, you know, took the oath and what we agreed to, and we handed out a little white paper. And we said, look, here's the talking points. From now on, all press releases, all communications, your website everywhere needs to describe what we're doing as software as a service, SaaS.
So,
and that's how we did it.
I mean, I think it's a term that I think if you're techie at all, you know it, and it's like, oh my gosh, like David Thomas. It's like it's a big deal. It's everywhere, right? Software as a service. I mean, Google, every cloud, everything cloud is software as a service. Now games, and it is like slowly eating, for better or worse.
What annoys me is this whole thing's like platform as a service. You know, it's all, everybody's adopted it for something else, right?
Right. You could say Uber is a kind of SaaS type thing. And it really caught fire.
It did.
What that moment that you're describing is really interesting to me because I think it's a moment where you have all these different entrepreneurs who, and CEOs from different businesses. Did you have any that were competitive with each other at the table?
Sure.
So you're all coming together to coordinate, to collaborate on something, even as competitors in some cases.
Because we needed a standard. Standards cut costs, right? If you can establish an industry standard, that you can all, then your costs all go down. And so, yeah, it's probably a public good, but you don't need the government to come to solve a public goods problem.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm getting at. Is I think that there's this sense, I think if you're sort of skeptical of companies and capitalism, you hear this story of this cabal gathering in the Bay Area that at Salesforce's tower to set a standard, but that's not, I mean, there was no downside to what you're describing. You're just trying to lay out a common language. It's like, so we can talk about this thing we're doing. And how often does that kind of thing happen in the business world from your perspective, that you sort of standards coalesce in a voluntary way?
Well, I didn't realize it happened a lot more than it does until later when I was running the Software Industry Association, because that's one of the things we did there, right, was we would bring all the companies together, and our job was to help develop standards for the industry. And then I realized, wow, there's actually organizations that are set up just to do this.
Yeah, so walk me through that, because that's the next step, isn't it?
That was the next step. So I was on the board of the Software Industry Association for several years. And then they asked me to be the chairman of the board. It's all volunteer, right? You choose to be. And so I was the chairman for a couple of years. And then the dot-com collapse put a lot of pressure on the association. And they asked me if I would come in as the executive director. And I said, I'll give you 3 years. So long. And I did 3 years. And I commuted back and forth, Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley during that time. And so that was an interesting experience because, you know, you're not only working with the heads of all the companies in the software industry, but you're also working with the political side of the business and the legal side of the business. And we also were the company that, the firm that sued people for copyright infringement and things like that. So it's a fairly interesting business.
And so this is where you got to see this sort of macro view of the industry at a different level.
I did.
What was the biggest challenge? I mean, there was the dot-com bust, but were there other challenges that you were starting to confront at the time? I know a lot, I know in the software space, patent thickets and patent trolling seems to have become more and more of a problem for tech companies. It seems like that, you know, were you dealing with those kind of issues? What were some of the challenges that you were looking at?
So those were, that was an issue that people talked about, but nothing really came of it because there was too much power. Too many people with too much power that you weren't going to solve that problem. One of the big problems was Microsoft versus the rest of the industry. Because Microsoft, of course, was a big time partner originally in the association. And of course, then there was this whole lawsuit of everybody against Microsoft, right? And that created this giant rift between Microsoft and the association. And they kind of went off and started another association to compete.
So I have a little bit of a conversion story that's sort of related to that moment. I was always a PC guy and I loved Microsoft. I thought they were great. I thought Apple sucked. And now anyone that knows me now knows that I'm wearing my Apple shirt that I got at that in celebration of tech for this conversation. But I read this Wired magazine article about the antitrust suit that really sort of turned me against Microsoft and in terms of the role that they played in the industry. And now looking back on it, having sort of gotten into economics and stuff, I feel like the opposite is true. I feel like, well, they got kind of a raw deal and that was sort of some cronyism with Novell and Orrin Hatch and some nonsense. And, you know, it was just more classic sort of antitrust shenanigans where a company that's giving consumers products for free gets dinged because other competitors aren't as good. I'm curious sort of if you're willing to sort of give your perspective on this, since you came up through this whole thing, you had a front row seat, and it sounds like a really like sort of even in the politics of it, a front row seat to this late 90s, early 2000s Microsoft.
So I would say the biggest problem that Microsoft had was in the way they treated other companies. There was clearly an arrogance, and rightly, you know, earned in terms of their success. But that arrogance, aggressive arrogance, really, I think, offended a lot of businesses. And I can remember that every year, Microsoft would have a special event in Silicon Valley, and they'd come down from Seattle, and they had this big tent. They'd invite everybody to come, and they would say, okay, here's what we're going to be announcing and releasing in the next year. Don't get into these businesses.
This is the classic FUD, right? Fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yeah. So basically the venture world would say, we're not investing in your business because that's on Microsoft's path. And all the money would dry up, right? So you had to clearly stay out of their way or you were dead. So that was one thing that they did. The other is Bill was actually kind of a soft-spoken guy. And he was very, you know, nerdy, soft-spoken sort of a guy, but aggressive. But Ballmer was a completely different story. Steve Ballmer scares the daylights out of me, okay? You've probably seen him in films on the sidelines for the Clippers, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, there's the developers, sweaty, screaming. It became like a meme. I mean, yeah. Yeah, I was just talking about him laughing about the iPhone with my business partner, Josh. It's like, oh, it's $600 and it doesn't have a keyboard. You know, and now they don't even sell a phone operating system. But yeah, he's a character for sure.
Yeah. So Steve was, a lot of people were afraid of Steve. And I can remember sitting at a table with him, you know, at several events. Anne was a close friend of his. And she'd say, come sit, you know, at our table with Steve. And so we'd do that. And he just so aggressive, so competitive, that it's just over the top, absolutely over the top. And so I think that that was something that really hurt Microsoft and maybe helped them. I don't know. But I remember, again, being at Agenda, and it was the year, it was actually the event in which Windows 3.0 was announced. And Windows 1.0 was a disaster because it was basically a ripoff of the Mac operating system, literally. But Windows 3.0 had been rewritten. And at that point in time, IBM and Microsoft had a partnership to come out with OS 2. And OS 2 was going to be a sort of semi-graphical user interface. It was going to be really nice. Secretly, Microsoft had been working on Windows 3.0. And Apple had approached them several years before about writing Excel and Word for the Mac operating system, because the leading companies at that time, which was WordPerfect and Lotus, refused to do so. And so Steve needed those products for the Mac. And so he had approached Microsoft, would you guys do this? And so they did. And they came out with Word and PowerPoint and Excel. So they had that working. So what they did was they also ported those over to the Windows operating system, already working, everything was great. But they hadn't told Lotus or WordPerfect about this. Those guys had been plowing ahead with OS 2. So I'm at this conference and Bill gets up and announces, we're abandoning OS 2. IBM's like, what? You know, and all these guys are going, what? We're abandoning OS 2. Instead, we're putting everything into Windows 3.0. And here it is. And by the way, it comes with Word and Excel and PowerPoint, and they're fully compatible with the files from Lotus and WordPerfect, and they run on the Mac as well, and you can go back and forth. And then he started to talk about how this was great for the industry. Nothing about great for Microsoft, this was great for the industry. It was a big day. The industry was going to be better off by doing this, because this was an improvement and everything was going to be better. And then he went back and he sat in the back of the room, Wall Street Journal, and he started rocking it. Well, the next speaker was Jim Manzi, and Jim Manzi was the CEO of Lotus. And Jim, I think, got a PhD in literature or something, right? So Jim gets up and he's clearly very upset, right? And he says, listening to Bill tout his honor and the honor of Microsoft in doing good for the industry reminds me of the quote, the more he touted his honor, the faster we counted our spoons. and that was the end of those companies. I mean, they just, and that they took them out. So Microsoft, you know, has a reputation of having done this over and over again, and people fear them. That's why their nickname is Mordor.
I've never heard that one, but of course.
People call them Mordor all the time. Yeah.
And you know, I think the thing that's so interesting that only hindsight can show is the way that's a window of time. So it was IBM was the unstoppable evil juggernaut, and then it was Microsoft. And now Microsoft's doing open source and they're giving Windows away and they're shipping phone products with Android and their browsers based on Chromium, and it's all different now.
Yeah.
So, you know, what how do you think about industry structures over time in light of just seeing so much transformation? Like, what is there, are there insights about the big picture that you've drawn from watching this industry evolve so radically?
Yeah, I used to feel like that, you know, there were monopolies and monopolies were a bad thing. But with my experience, I have come to the conclusion that the only monopolies that are bad are ones that are created through coercion by the government. Natural monopolies are a good thing, and they're good for consumers, they're good for business. And so a Microsoft who develops a monopoly in, you know, Word and Excel and those products, or even an operating system, is that really bad for consumers? Well, the thing is that a natural monopoly has a very, very high upfront fixed cost and then a very low marginal cost. So as they sell more and more of the product, the average cost continues to decline. You know, to actually distribute another copy of Office costs Microsoft maybe 10 cents or something, right?
Super cheap.
And so as they sell more and more of them, their average cost continues to go down. Does it make sense to have four different providers of products like that? No, because they all have to develop the upfront cost, and then the average cost is going to be four times as high. So consumers have to pay four times as much for a product, and the products aren't necessarily going to be as compatible with each other and so forth. So I believe that those kinds of natural monopolies make sense. Now, if you're Microsoft, do you ever lose any sleep? Do you ever worry? Sure. Because if you charge too much, somebody is going to come in and compete with you, as long as they can get their average cost down below yours, right? So you're going to have to keep your costs low. You can make a good profit, but you have to keep your costs low to keep those other people out, right? The other problem you have is institutional inertia. So a Microsoft gets everything built around Office, everything built around Windows, their whole business, their distribution model, right? And then along comes Netscape.
Right.
And now what?
Yeah, I remember in the late 90s, Microsoft was investing in like encyclopedias and talking about CD-ROMs as the future. And then the internet comes along, and it was really quite a famous, it was a famous like early miss from Gates that he missed the importance of the internet at the early stage. I mean, they caught up quick. They caught up, but yeah, it is pretty interesting. Do you think that's sort of inherent that when you have that kind of natural monopoly that you're going to become a little more bureaucratic and lethargic?
Yeah, it creates institutional inertia. There was a company years ago called Siebel Systems, and it was founded by Tom Siebel, and they were the number one customer relationship management system, CRM system. Very expensive, you know, $500,000, $1 million, $5 million systems that big corporations would buy for managing customers. They owned the market, absolutely did. They were doing great. Well, when Benioff came out with Salesforce.com, it was like CRM on the, you know, as a service, right? He was laughing at it. And I was at this conference, and they were both supposed to speak, and Benioff didn't show up. And so Siebel got up and he said, look, he says, this is a total joke. They'll be bankrupt within a year. A year later, Tom's sales were down 25% and they were taking off. At that point, and this is where the story becomes interesting, Tom realized his mistake. And so he went out and bought Salesforce's biggest competitor, and said, well, now we'll offer that same capability as well, side by side with ours. But the problem is that their institution was built around, their business was built around the institution of enterprise software, which is field salespeople, field support people. You're selling $500,000 systems, right? You don't sell a little $50 a month service that eliminates a $500,000 sale. Your salespeople are not even going to try, right? So they bought this company, paid a lot of money for it, and then never sold any of it.
Yeah, I feel like these sort of institution organizational dynamics is an area that economics as a discipline, doesn't have a lot of work in, doesn't have, it's, they're sort of like, the firm is this like black box abstraction. And
well, there's a whole field, there's a whole field of economics called new institutional economics. That's what they're studying.
Yeah, that's, I've heard about new institutional economics from like Pete Betke and others, but I'm not familiar with it. But I mean, it's
but it's brand new. I mean, it's very, very new, right? It's North and Elder Ostrom and people like that. I'm working on a paper right now on multi-tenant architectures. So I've taken that idea of my computer model and said, do we have firms that are actually multi-firm firms? And the answer is, well, yes, of course, right? I mean, a mall is a firm of firms, right? And an airport is a firm of firms. And a hospital is a firm, and a university. And what are the benefits and strengths of having a multi-tenant firm? That needs to be studied, right? So I'm working on a paper to analyze the strengths and weaknesses of why these things exist and should exist. For example, I think universities could be structured very differently if they became more multi-tenant firms. So a university could basically have the basic infrastructure, the buildings or whatever, and then say, okay, we need a business school. Hey, Harvard, we'd like to license you. You come in and be our business school. And we want you to be our nursing school. We want you, and we'll provide all the infrastructure, and all you have to do is come in, and we'll bring the students. And it's just like a mall, right? Now think how much better education would be if we did that.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like thinking about the companies as platforms. Like, what are the capabilities that are applicable across multiple domains? Like, where can you kind of combine? I worked inside Viacom, which was I was at MTV, Nickelodeon, and Spike TV, which became Paramount Network now. And Viacom was a, you know, media conglomerate. So each of these were business units. They had their own P&Ls. They had their own corporate cultures, which is something that I came to like take a lot of interest in, because as I moved around inside from, you know, 50th and Broadway down to 45th, and then from the 38th floor to the 42nd floor, and the floor names had meaning. Like, oh, are you on 42? Oh yeah, I'm on 42. Like, it was just and there was always this interesting tension in that environment between, it was kind of my first taste of Hayek's ideas about central planning versus local knowledge, because, you know, the corporate sort of Viacom center spinal things like HR, IT, always felt like lame and unrelated to my work. And like HR didn't know, like we never turned to HR for hiring because they didn't know anything about the needs of our particular department or my department. Right. And like the centralized, they would swing, they'd outsource IT to IBM, and it's like, we're all on Macs. What are they doing? And they'd swing it back in-house. And so it was always this interesting tension between the tenants, I guess, and the needs that were particular to the tenants' business versus the macro picture that Viacom had as kind of like this venture fund of media brands or whatever their business model. They were always trying to sell across them. But then you'd see these weird, just to wrap up my rant. But one of the other things that was interesting inside that model was, again, like speaking of weird incentives inside sales teams, is each channel was ultimately selling its audience to advertisers. That was fundamentally its product, was its audience.
Right.
And so there was this tension between the per channel sales teams and then integrated cross channel sales. And the problem with the cross channel is if I'm a salesperson and I get incentivized for how much I sell, and I have this portfolio, and it includes Spike and Nickelodeon and MTV and Comedy Central, and right now, the hottest thing is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Well, I'm just going to sell that. I'm going to go in the room and I'm going to sell Daily Show.
Sure.
And so that incentive damages the other business units, because there's plenty of people out there that don't want to buy Daily Show. They want to buy Spike and Guy Comedy or whatever. So like those internal things of like, well, who's got the decision rights and how does it align with the incentives and the business operations is all really interesting stuff. I mean, it sort of speaks to exactly the stuff you're talking about looking at.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge. I mean, if you look at a mall, for example, why would people go into a mall? Why would you take your business into a mall? Well, because the mall is going to bring a whole bunch of customers there. When I want to go shopping, I'll say to my wife, "Hey, let's go to the mall."
Right.
I don't say, "Let's go to Brooks Brothers." Let's go to the mall. I really mean go to Brooks Brothers. But while we're there, we're going to stop by the Apple Store and a bunch of other stuff. Right? So the idea is that my going to Brooks Brothers brings me to Apple. And my going to Apple brings me to Brooks Brothers. And so the benefit of the multi-tenant firm is in bringing all those customers together. There has to be a common space. And Amazon is a common virtual space. So right. They have thousands and hundreds of thousands of sellers. And what they do is they reduce the search costs and the bargaining costs and everything else. But I can go there and I can find that rare book that I needed for my research. And I'm probably going to find it there. And I'm never going to find it anywhere else because the search costs are way too high. Right? And so the fact that they've created a multi-tenant firm, a firm of firms, to allow all these people to come together into a marketplace, if you will. But it's in a common place. All these benefits of the multi-tenant firm make a huge difference.
So
yeah, we're seeing a movement away from that, right? Hospitals are actually buying up doctors' practices and becoming bigger and bigger sort of conglomerates. And I think they're moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think certainly. And that in that instance in particular, and my dad's a doctor, and so we've watched all the private practices getting dissolved, and that's all a big government screw job from what I could see. You've got the big hospitals have these protective tariff like things at the state level, so they get giant, and then they exert this legal monopoly power on the docs, and it all sucks right. To be a doctor because of the billing and all that. So all the doctors are like, I just want to do medicine. I don't want to have a 14-person billing department. So I'll just give up on being a medical entrepreneur and become an employee. And now suddenly, instead of taking calls from your patients at midnight on a Saturday, you're clocking 9 to 5 and everyone loses.
Well, we could do 2 hours on that. Right? Yeah. One of my fields of study is health economics. You know, as you're aware, I do the 911 research for that field. But I have developed, because of my experiences in Silicon Valley and so forth, I've developed a solution to the healthcare problem, which basically has to do with sort of blowing it up, right? But it's a very simple, elegant solution. But the insurance companies are not going to like it. But we have the best medical care system in the world and the worst insurance system in the world. Absolutely. The best and the worst. And the only thing that's close to being as bad as what we have is socialized medicine, like they have at the VA. So everybody says, let's go to the socialized medicine's better. It is better, right? But then we're trapped. We're stuck in that. And there are things that are way better than that that we could do. And then we're trapped into a central government solution. So you know, we got stuck with this third party payer system because of World War II. And now how do we get out of it? Because it's a disaster.
Well, we are going to definitely have to have a follow-up conversation about that, David. So, okay. So you're at, so let's talk about, in the time we've got left, your transition out of the world of business and into the world of academia and okay. Why you would do such a thing.
well, my friend Otis Sayas said, when I was, I said, I'm going to get my PhD. He said, you're doing it backwards. You get your PhD and then you do these things. I said, no, you did it backwards. And he thought for a minute. He said, you might be right. You might be
right. So you're in this executive director role, which is sort of maybe dipping your toe into a more academic-y type of thing in a certain sense. You know, you're dealing with policies and macro pictures and not necessarily a business bottom line.
Certainly, it revives my love for economics and the need for it. But it also was a 40-hour-a-week job. And I hadn't had a 40-hour-a-week job in a long time. I was used to working 100-hour-plus weeks. You know, people don't realize that a greedy CEO wakes up in the morning, and until they go to bed at night, they think one thought. How do I make my customers happier? That's it. That doesn't sound like a greedy person, does it? How do I make my product less expensive and better so my customers are happier and so they'll stay and buy more products so I can become rich? No, it's how do I make my customers happier? That is your thought all the time.
Well, it's a good friend of mine said capitalism is the most moral system because it is the only one in which you have to give before you can receive. Yeah. And I think that sums up what you're saying. It is, you know, the term customer service is throughout the whole system precisely because that's what it's all about.
I can guarantee you that a government bureaucrat never crosses his mind, how do I make my customers happy?
That might be a little unfair, David. I think there's probably, I think systematically, no, but anecdotally, I'm sure there's plenty of people who feel like I'm in it to do good and help people and social workers and all that kind of stuff.
I'm sure that's how it started out. But the frustration that they feel being a part of a bureaucracy and not being able to make changes is, let me get out of here as quickly as I can and get home so I can work on my hobbies.
Yeah, I've heard that firsthand from a lot of teachers in particular who get in with these big ideas of how they're going to help kids, and 3 years in, they're like, this is the worst. So, okay. You're thinking, I'm ready for something else.
I'm working 40 hours a week, and I thought, why not go back to school, finish my degree? I have one semester left, so I did that. And then I told my wife, I said, you know what? I want to go ahead and get a master's degree since I'm doing this anyway in economics. And it's a 2-year program, but I can do it in a year in the evenings. So while I'm working 40 hours a week, I just went back to school and got my master's degree in 1 year. It was a little tough, but I finished it. And as I was finishing it, I told my wife, I think I would really like to be a professor. I said, I'm tired of having to deal with employees and shareholders and the stresses, and I'm getting older and I have all these ideas. And I think as a professor, I'd be able to do all the things I like to do with none of the things that I hate to do. So I can work on my own ideas. I can be creative. I can solve problems. I can have good colleagues that I like to associate with. And I like to teach. I've always enjoyed doing that because that's what a CEO does mostly. And then I don't have to deal with any of the accounting and reporting to the board or any of that kind of stuff. And she said, okay. And she had always wanted to finish her degree anyway. So we both went back to school and she finished her bachelor's degree and I got my PhD.
So you were at George Mason.
Yes.
Which is home to many of my favorite economists.
And mine too.
And what did you come away, you know, what were your biggest ahas during that PhD time at GMU? Like because at this point you're a seasoned entrepreneur, managed big organizations, you know, what could you learn from these geeks and these academic ivory tower heads at GMU?
Well, so I've always been a free market guy. I've always believed in markets for solving problems politically and monetarily. And George Mason was very compatible with that idea. I always liked reading Friedman and Hayek and Mises and these guys. And so that was, it was very easy for me to say, like, if I can get into Mason, I'll go. I didn't even apply anywhere else. I just said, if I can get into Mason, I'll go. Otherwise, I'm going to waste my time. So they let me come in. I think they saw me as like, oh, well, he'll write out a check and fill in a seat, you know. And the way these programs work is they bring in about 35 people in each cohort. And then you have a year of classes. And if you get a C in any of the classes, you have to be taken. And then at the end of the year, you have to take two exams. These are like, you can't move ahead without these two exams. And they're pass-fail, and quite a few of the students fail. I think 20 out of the 35 failed the first exam. I think by the time I finished, 8 of us graduated.
Wow.
It's tough, right? And so I was lucky because I was married and I was highly focused. And so all I did was just prepare and study. And my wife really helped me a lot. And so I passed the two exams the first time. Whew, it takes a lot of pressure off. I remember being at the bedside of my younger brother who was dying of colon cancer and in last stages. And I hadn't got my grades yet. What I passed but failed. And I got a text message. And I looked and said, you passed. And I told my brother, we kind of, yeah, you know, it's a great thing. And so then I selected my fields and moved on. And of course, it's normally a 4-year program. Typically, people take 6 years to finish. I was older and I didn't want to take that long. So I pushed really hard to get through in 3. And I did. I got through in 3. In the middle of all of that, I had a brain tumor. So I started going blind at the end of my 2nd year, and I was going into my final class and one more class to take. And we were at Costco, and my wife said, "Look, the C is burned out on Costco. We were getting gas." And she said, "No, it hasn't. It's right there." And I couldn't see it. So we went through a series of doctors and finally the neurosurgeon, he showed me this ping pong ball sized tumor right in the middle of my head. It wasn't cancerous, but it had to be removed. And it sits right between the optic nerve, the brainstem, and the carotid artery. So you have to do something. What's cool is they actually go up through your nose, cut into the skull, go in and remove it. And so there's no visible scars. Amazing.
Amazing. Yeah. What is that called? Endoscopic surgery, I think.
Yeah. It was interesting because that particular day of the surgery, we had a blizzard in Washington, D.C. Now, I'm having this done by the top neurosurgeon of Washington, D.C. at the same hospital they took Ronald Reagan to, right? So MedStar. And so we find out the blizzard's coming, and I'm scheduled for 4:30 in the morning. So my wife and I said, we can't do this. So we drove into Washington, D.C. You know, we took the train into Washington, D.C. And we checked into a really, really nice hotel a half mile from the hospital. And then we had a cab scheduled for us. So we go down there at 4 o'clock, 4:15 in the morning. And there's this cab. There's 4 feet of snow. And there is not a car on the road. Right? And this guy is going to drive us a half a mile. So we had it worked out. We were going to pay him a big tip. And we're sliding through the snow, and we get there. I'm thinking, is the surgeon even going to show up? Right? He came. So.
Oh yeah. So you had a good friend as a professor at this point, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Well, Brian Kaplan was the professor for this last class. And anybody who's taking class with Brian knows how hard he is. He gives his exams. He targets 50% as the median. It just makes it that hard, right? And then he curves it, right? So very, very difficult class. And it was one of my field studies. I had to finish this in order to take my field exam. And so I went to him. It was 2 weeks into the semester. And I brought my MRI to him. And I said, you know, can you help me? And he said, that is the best excuse anybody's ever given me. And so you won't have to do the homework for the first half of the semester. You'll get twice as much for the second half, and then no midterm score. We'll put it all on the final. Anyway, I got a B, which was passing, but it was disappointing because I should have done better than that.
So you get your PhD and you know, in our prior conversation, you said something that was interesting to me and sort of surprising. You said that you encountered ageism in academia. Tell me about that.
Oh, clearly academia looks at this as, you know, we're investing in you as a prospect and we want to have you for 40 years, right? We want to have you for a very long time. So we want to get you young. We want to get you through the 10-year process and then you're going to produce all this research and everything for us. So what's a guy who's, you know, just turning 60, what good is he going to do us, right? He'll be ready to retire before he gets tenure. So we don't want to invest in somebody like that because we're not going to get any value out of it.
See, the thing that I find so shocking about that is, and if I can, and pardon this, but a lot of the research academics do is just nonsense. So it's like self-indulgent bullshit. And not to say there isn't incredible research as well, but the research part of the academic thing, I don't fully understand. But if you're a professor, I would think that as an educational institution, to get David Thomas to be on our staff as an economics professor, having started up all these companies and having been at the forefront of all this technological revolution in America and the world, how is that anything other than a slam dunk? Like, that's shocking to me. Like, if I want to come in as a student, I would like to believe that you're exactly the kind of professor that this school is desperate to hire.
Nobody had any interest in it.
So is it just, this research part that takes precedent over the value to the students in your view? Like, I don't get it. Like, isn't the...
Well, certainly the research is way more valued than the teaching. Now, I was teaching at George Mason for 3 years because I had a master's degree in, and ratemyprofessors.com had me rated as the number one professor in Virginia. And so, you know, I thought that will help me, right? Because students find me interesting and I have all these stories to tell and everything. But nobody really cared. It's about research. And I thought, well, I've got this great research on 911 and murders and that should be really interesting to people, but I think a lot of them saw it as trying to be too bold. One of my professors told me, you're trying to do things with too big of ideas. You're trying to work on too important of ideas. Stop trying to do that. You're not going to come up with anything important. What you need to do is focus on some very small piece of the existing literature and flesh it out. That's what your job is. You're not going to come up with Coase's theorem of the firm. You're not going to come up with any big ideas. So don't even try. Stop trying to do that.
I mean, that to me is one more example of a kind of systematic breakdown of the university as a thing. This specialization to the point of well past the margin of error and the utility margin of error. Like, okay, you got to be narrowed down to some super duper subspecialty that assumes all the other crap we've already done is true, and just find at the margin where people make mistakes and do a research do that. Show me some other way that people screw up in the choices they make, and you'll be fine.
So here's an example of this. So I mentioned my father was a physicist, and he always felt like the Big Bang Theory was a little bit simplistic and had a lot of problems. But boy, I'll tell you, if you ever say that in that world, you know, they will, you're out, okay? So in 1999, when Saul Perlmutter discovered that the universe was accelerating, which was just like, no, that's not what, it doesn't fit, right? It can't be accelerating. Everybody said, well, we can't let go of the Big Bang Theory. Therefore, there has to be this something called dark energy. We don't know what it is, but there's something we're going to call dark energy that's making this happen. but they can't let go of the Big Bang Theory, right? So my father said, wait a minute. This is a huge piece of evidence that flies in the face of the Big Bang. Maybe we should go back to the beginning and rethink. And so he went back and he said, okay, so the universe is itself is moving away from the cell all over in every direction. That could be from a Big Bang. Or maybe space expands. The nature of space is that it just expands. It's a vector field and it just expands. Call it dark energy, really. Now that's just the nature of space. If that happened, would it explain everything that we see today? Yes. And so he developed this theory called expanded space theory, which I have all his papers. He passed away 10 or 15 years ago, and I'm kind of carrying his work forward. But the idea of, and now they're starting to talk about it, right? After all these years, been 20 years since Perlmutter discovered this, they're starting to kind of talk about inflation theory and things, but this is the way it works, right? Very, 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 very slow. Whereas, you know, a Hubble could discover redshift and everybody immediately adapts and changes, right? Not anymore.
Yeah, it is. I mean, maybe it's just a reflection of human nature. You know, we're curious, but we're also scared and change averse. And so that gets baked into our norms of our organizations and in different ways. And the change agents are always going to be iconoclasts. And we just, whether or not we progress or not is whether or not the society is, doesn't just string up our iconoclasts. Like, this is the thing that worries me the most about the trajectory of American culture is the more Maoist struggle session-y we get, the more we are in danger of not having the room for the David Thomas type iconoclasts to say, well, I don't care that you don't want me to have big ideas. I'm going to have them anyway and just go.
It's just too much fun. It's too much fun. I love it. I love doing that. If you go on the internet and search, you'll find a talk I gave before the iPhone came out. And I was asked to talk about, you know, the future of computing. And so I gave this talk. It was at Stanford to about 1,000 CEOs and stuff. And I said, okay, look, we started out with mainframes. And then people needed access in real time. So we moved to time sharing. And then people said, but I need to have the computing on my desk where I can work. And so we developed the desk because we needed spreadsheets, right? And then email came along. And email said, I need to bring my computer with me when I travel. So we moved to the laptop, right? And then the internet became where we work. And so we need a new computer. And it's not a desktop computer, and it's not a laptop computer. It's a webtop computer. And then let me describe a webtop computer. It's a phone you carry with you. It's always on. It's got a touch screen. It's got GPS, so it knows where we are. And then I went on to describe all the features of the iPhone, right? And then like 9 months later, the iPhone comes out. And I said, the first webtop computer, there it is, right? So I quickly bought a whole bunch of Apple stock.
I'm going to have to find this talk. That is I remember seeing a demo of multi-touch, and it was on a big canvas-like screen. And it was, and it was at this moment, I had already had my like conversion to being an Apple lunatic experience. But I was like, okay, so, you know, Steve has like resuscitated Apple, and now we've got this great Unix-based operating system, but like, what's the next thing? Like, these paradigm shifts are such a big deal, and is Apple going to be able to, like, now that they're finally back on their feet, is it this multi-touch? Is it database? You know, there was Windows was trying to have this database file system, WinFS, and what's going to happen? And then out comes the iPhone, and it was like, oh my God, they've crossed this Rubicon has been crossed, and
it was the webtop computer. That's what it was, right? So 5 years ago, I started telling my students that I know a couple of futurists. You know, one is at Google, I don't know him personally, but I know of him and read his work. And one I know personally, Robin Hanson. And a futurist is somebody who tries to predict sort of that next anomaly that's going to change the world, right? What is it going to be? And they're always wrong. And almost always wrong. Because it ends up being something like the pill or like transistor radios, or, you know, something like that. And so I've been thinking a lot about what it might be. So 5 years ago, I started saying it's telepresence. It's the idea that through technology, we can do exactly what we're doing right now, that we can be in each other's presence without actually physically being there. Because it's going to change education. It's going to change our families. It's going to change everything. Travel is going to destroy industries, creative destruction on steroids. But it's going to be telepresence. I said, it's going to be 20 years. But the basic seeds are there, and you experience it with FaceTime. FaceTime is what turned me on to it. It's like, okay, look at FaceTime. But it's this big, right? But imagine that. Imagine a wall in one of your rooms that with the push of a button becomes the living room of your children, and you're visiting. You can't hug, but you can do everything else, right? Imagine a wall that becomes the beach in Maui, becomes the classroom, whatever. We're very close to that right now, right? And so I said, this is what's coming. And I would tell my students semester after semester, this is what's coming. Little did I know the pandemic, right? So the pandemic, it just cut 10 years off of it, right? So this is the future, telepresence. It's going to change everything about the way we work and how we live. And all the companies that are in the telepresence supporting business, so Zoom, and Apple, these other companies that provide technologies and support for it, are going to become incredibly successful.
Yeah, I saw a recent interview with Mark Zuckerberg that was talking about this in the context of their investments in Oculus and VR. And it's such an interesting, it's like everything with innovation, right? It has all these great capabilities it unlocks, and then it has some unintended consequences, costs, and pathological outcomes that come along for the ride, because change is never purely positive. And I guess as we're kind of coming to a close on our conversation, I'm curious where you think we are in grappling with that in the sort of current cycle of the tech that's in our lives right now. Because I think we're all grappling with this new world of information. I've been very impacted by Martin Gurry, who's a GMU, well, he's at Mercatus, but his book, The Revolt of the Public, and he talks a lot about this, that, you know, there's a lot of social upheaval that I think that very well could be at its fundamental level information technology driven. What do you think about that? Like, how do you think about the downsides or the current crop of challenges that all this connectivity and tech progress has sort of unleashed?
Stuart Elsoff once told me that one of the worst things that could ever happen to us would be if we lost the editors, the people that can process information and make it, prepare it for us in a meaningful form that's useful. If we're just in front of fire hoses, it's going to destroy us. And I agree with him. And so I don't believe that, quote, information per se is the issue. I think connection with people. It's about being able to connect with each other. We focus in economics on private goods and public goods and common goods and so on. And they're all about rival versus non-rival and all this kind of stuff. But there's another kind of good that nobody's ever talked about before. And I call it a conducible good. And we have these goods. They're all around us. But we never think of them as goods. But a conducible good is one when we jointly consume it, our utility actually goes up. Whereas a plate of cookies, you eat some, there's less for me. Okay, or if you watch the TV, it doesn't affect me. Okay, it doesn't affect me. But if we both use Facebook, the fact that we're friends makes Facebook better. The fact that I want to go see a football game with other people so I can hear them cheer makes it a conducive good. Sitting around the family table with the family so we can discuss ideas or makes eating dinner a better experience, right? They're conducive expensive goods, right? And I think this is where the future is. The future is going to be in resurrecting and building conducive goods that bring people together, that make the experiences richer for us. And that's why I think telepresence is going to be big, but it's going to be things like that, not information. Information may drive it, but I think in a lot of ways we need to stop getting so much information, right? There's too much information.
A friend of mine who's been on the program, Bob Metcalf.
Oh, Bob.
I imagine you know. And what you're describing sounds a lot like, in a way, like Metcalf's law. You know, that the value of the network is related to the number of nodes. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's at a more human scale than network.
Yeah, but it's about human and connectivity and the warmth and so forth that we get from interacting with each other. That value is being lost, and now we have to bring it back. Bob Metcalf was one of the original scientists at Palo Alto Research Center at PARC, and he developed Ethernet. Yep. He was the inventor of Ethernet. Brilliant guy.
Well, as we wrap up, I know we've got our group conversation on some of your macro research, which we're gonna, I think, be putting up and we'll link to. Where can people find you and what you're doing?
That's a good question. I have a website, davidchandlerthomas.com. I put up some things there. A lot of my research right now is kind of behind the scenes. My research into expanding space, I haven't posted up anything yet, but I'm creating some visual models of how that looks. In terms of my 911 research, that's on the internet. They can Google me on Google Scholar and read my papers. My current research on 911 is interesting because it shows that 911 reduced the murder rate in half. And that's pretty significant. That half as many people are being murdered today because of 911. And there are other benefits there as well. So it's empirical research in that way. And I've uncovered a bunch of other things related to that. So yeah, I've got about 8 papers up right now on business cycle theory, and those are up there. They've been published and so forth.
All right. Well, David, thank you for taking the time with me. It's been a journey into one of my favorite things, which is that intersection of entrepreneurship and technology.
It's a lot of fun.
It's really great. So thank you so much, and I'm looking forward to sharing.
Well, thanks for letting me talk about it. I don't get to talk much about it, so it's kind of fun.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Emergent Order podcast. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app. If you're interested in being a guest, shoot us an email at podcast@emergentorder.com. Our producer is Jesse Bennett. Thanks again, and speak to you next time.